Zechariah, Old Testament book, chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 1. Then I turned and raised my eyes and saw that there was a flying scroll. Verse 2, and he said to me, "Did you see that?" And so I answered, "I see a flying scroll. The length is 20 cubits." So it's not rolled up. It's actually laid open and flying. And it's huge. It's 20 cubits, about 30 feet in width and 10 in length and 10 cubits in its width. Pardon me. 20 cubits long, 10 cubits wide. So for us, that'd be about 30 by 15. It's unrolled and it's laid out. And you're going to see here in a minute, it's written on both sides. What does this mean? Fascinating to me. Those are the exact dimensions of Moses' tabernacle. 20 cubits long, 15 cubits wide. God's house, and those actual measurements are in Exodus chapter 26, verses 15 through 25. Also, we find out that these are the proportions when Solomon builds the tabernacle out of stone and he increases all of the measurements. We find out that the Bible mentions in 1 Kings 6, verse 3, this is Solomon's porch. Interesting. Visions 8 through 10 are about God's judgment. Where does God always begin his judgment? In his house first. I wonder if that's why the dimensions of the scroll were what they were. And of course, Zechariah being a priest, he would be familiar with those proportions. Verse 3, then he, this angel walking me around, very likely Jesus himself, because he's referred to as the angel, could be Jesus, a resurrected Jesus, who ascended from the Mount of Olives in Acts chapter 1, but then he slips into that multidimensional system where God lives, where there is no linear time, and it would appear that Jesus' resurrected body can be reinserted, anywhere in the timeline, and I believe here's one, verse 3. So he, I believe it's Jesus, said, "Now this scroll is an indictment, if you will. It's a curse, and it's written on both sides." Legal documents in those days, they had a smooth side because paper wasn't easy to come by. So there were all kinds of techniques, and often you would take papyrus and the Egyptians would be only too happy to supply you that. And then you would work it in such a way that one side was sort of smooth. That was the writing surface. And usually, if it was a legal document, you had provisos. Both parties agree to do ABC. And if it is in default, then you flip it over. And on the rough side, you would write what needed to happen to redeem that contract that is in default. So here we're going to see in a minute that's written on both sides. Hey, that rings a bell. When John goes up to heaven and he sees a scroll up there, is it also written on both sides? It is. And it's sealed with seven seals. So we have here a precursor to Revelation chapter 5. Remember, when we get to the book of Revelation, for many it's tough to read because they don't understand that the book of Revelation assumes that you have a working knowledge of your Old Testament. So to the uninitiated who's never read the book of Zechariah, they're like, huh, a scroll written on both sides. I wonder what that is. We're going to see here that God tells us what it is. These are provisos. These are what God is instructing as judgments. And we know that because it's written on both sides. So he said, this is a curse, if you will. This is a retribution and a punishment. Fascinating that the Hebrew word here for curse is the Hebrew word Allah. Allah. Interesting. Linguistically, there are a lot of similarities between Hebrew and some of the Arabic dialects, Farsi and what have you. It's just kind of an interesting observation to me that here in the Bible, for curse or retribution and punishment is so similar to the Arabic reference to their God. fascinating to me. It's from the same root, but it's very different from the word for God in the Old Testament is I am that I am, YHWH. What does that mean? That transliterates to the eternal existing one. Fascinating that Allah, the God of Islam, kind of is similar to that, which means retribution and curse. And if you sort of unpack much of that theology, that seems to be a theme running through it all. But Jehovah, the eternal existing one, they are so not the same God. If you're ever curious about that, a little digging in, you're going to find out that Allah is from Muhammad and his background and how he arrived at that. That is a descendant of the moon god of Mecca and Medina. You go on Ramadan and you go to that month of fasting and what have you, and you go to your pilgrimage. It's one of the five pillars of Islam. You got to do it or you're not getting in the door. You got to go to Mecca and Medina. One of the things you do is you kind of do a big circle around this thing in the middle. It's a big black box. And that is a portion of a stone that fell to earth in Abraham's time. And because it fell from the earth, then Mecca and Medina were polytheistic. And they had all kinds of other gods. And so what you would do is you would go to the Kabul, which is this place where they featured this meteorite. And then you walked around it seven times. And then you would take a stone and you would wander over to a little wadi or a wash, and then you would throw rocks at the devil. All right. When Muhammad shows up, he first tries to appease or appeal to the monotheistic God of the Jews as well. Did you know that the Muslims used to pray in the direction of Jerusalem? They did. Until the Jewish people there said, Allah is not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. No way. So then, fine. Then they now reverse that, and now they face Mecca and Medina, no matter where you are on the planet. But you still get to Mecca. You still have to go around the Kabul. If you've ever seen pictures of it, it's tremendously built out now, and there are so many millions that go back there. You can't really walk around sort of on the pavement, so they have multiple layers, and so you have jillions of people moving around the Kabul seven times. And guess what? You still go grab a rock or bring it with you, and you go down to the Wadi Mina and you throw rocks at the devil there too. Please understand that the God of Islam is not in any way near in shape, understanding, or theology near the God Jehovah, the voice of the burning bush. Is everybody clear with that? They're just sort of the two same gods. No, they're not. They're hugely different. Back to our study. Verse 3, then he said to me, this scroll is a curse. So now we have a little more understanding of the scroll that is seen in heaven in Revelation chapter 5. This is the curse that goes out over the face of the whole earth. Not just here in Jerusalem, because that's where Zechariah is. And every thief shall be expelled according to this side of the scroll. And every perjurer shall be expelled according to that side. So it's written on both sides. And as I said, because it's unrolled, we can see the scroll is written on both sides. Did you know that the table of the law, tablets, the stone tablets in Exodus 32 were also written on both sides? Stealing, of course, is commandment number 8. Don't do that. That's in the midst of the second tablet, if you will. And perjury, or taking the Lord's name in vain, the third commandment, is in the midst of the first tablet. So there's some similarities there. And like the scroll in the book of Revelation chapter 5, written on both sides, they are sealed with 7 seals, and then those seals are popped. And of course, then that begins the judgments of the book of Revelation. Verse 4. I will send out the curse, really my judgment, says the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name. It shall remain in the midst of his house and consume it, which is timber and stones. Those horrific fires that we saw race through the Palisades and so on in Southern California, those houses were burned, but typically what was left, the steel and the masonry. This is saying God's judgment is going to be so complete, there's going to be no timbers and no stone, no fireplaces, no nothing. This huge scroll is God's record of sins against him and other people. This is probably reminiscent of the books that will be opened on Judgment Day as well. Everybody understands it. Well, how are these judgments sort of executed? Does God blow from heaven and then everything happens? For your consideration, I think that a very, very important principle regarding sin are these three verses. Verse number one, Numbers 32, 23, which is cool. If you have OCD, you love that number. 32, 23. It's the same backwards and forwards. Be absolutely certain, God said, your sins will find you out. Now, what does that mean, they'll find you out? Like a detective, they'll sniff, sniff, sniff. Aha! Here's another one. Proverbs 26, 27. Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and he who rolls a stone will have it roll back on him. In other words, when you exert energy for muhahaha, sinful sort of designs, God sees to it that it's a principle. It's gonna come back and bite you. How we have described it here in the West, what goes around comes around. And then here's Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man sows, that will he reap. I wonder if much of the judgment of God is him not really activating anything specific, although it might. And even in the book of Revelation, many of the judgments that are scorching planet Earth is God taking his hands off of the humans and letting them destroy one another. Because after all, many of the people who aren't going to be in heaven forever and ever, they're there because they live their whole life here under the sun. I don't want God. I don't believe there is God. I don't want him. And reluctantly, with a heavy heart, God gives them an eternity of just that. But please remember, hell is so awful because nothing of God's attributes will be there. Is hell so horrific because God in his imagineerings or whatever, like Disneyland has engineering's a fun play on the word engineer. Did God just sort of invent really terrible and cruel ways to torture people? Is that why hell is so bad? Hell is so bad because he's not there. And because he's not there, neither is his light, his love, his healing, his rest, all the things that we cherish here, none of that is going to be in hell. Hell's not going to be too bad because I'll just, at least my buddies will be there. You don't understand. Camaraderie and trust, which makes a friendship. Who invented those? God did. So that's not going to be there either. It'll be every person for themselves in pitch blackness. Oh, remember, hell was not made or designed for humans, it was designed for fallen angels, so they'll be there too. And don't forget, take a cross section of angels, we find that some of them are very, very large, and then various size and various strengths. If a cross section of those angels fell following Lucifer, it makes sense that some demons are worse than others. What are the demons doing there? They're probably taking out their own rage and frustration on the new bodied people, humans, who had their disembodied spirits rejoined with their physical bodies, and those physical bodies, like what we got at the rapture, they're going to exist for all eternity in those physical bodies, likely that will feel pain, because in heaven we are experiencing pleasure. There's a river running through the New Jerusalem. It's crystal clean, clear. It would seem that we can drink of that river freely. I don't know that we'll need or require water to live, but how many of you know when you're very thirsty, how pleasurable is an ice-cold glass of water? It's an idea of refreshing. So our physical bodies that we get in the rapture, this body is changed in a moment in the twinkling of an eye, and this corruption puts on incorruption. In the New Jerusalem, we eat and we drink because it is pleasurable, not because we have to. Will those eternally separated have a sense of thirst, have a sense of hunger? I don't know. I couldn't explain it accurately. But the point of it is, these new bodies attuned to the multidimensional system where God lives, experiencing all of that light and love in enormous quantities. In hell, those new bodies are going to be absorbing all of that darkness and fear and anger and potentially physical injury, thirst. It's unimaginable to try to put that on emotionally. Hell is going to be so indescribably awful because none of God's mercy and grace will be there. And left alone to sort of fend for themselves are humans in their new bodies, probably being tortured and chased and harassed by fallen angels. It's absolutely horrific. This notion here that sin is so awful and judgment is visited for every blasphemer and every liar is probably a notion that God just takes his hands off of somebody's life. You are so bent on going there. Do you know that's going to wipe you out? Much of what judgment, God's judgment is simply God saying, go ahead and knock yourself out. And I wonder if that's a part of this. God's judgment on an unrepentant heart is often just taking away his hand of mercy and protection and let the natural consequences of poor decisions do their thing. And in this case, God allows these nations and people to completely destroy themselves. Not even fireplaces are left. Now we're going to get into vision number 9. Now we know what that scroll is about. And do you see that that illustration and understanding here is probably going to give us a lot of insight when we get to Revelation 5. Now we're going to go to something else that's actually kind of cool, kind of weird, kind of cool, and kind of frightening all at the same time. It's vision number 9. It's another great judgment. It's a harlot who's in a basket. Right in your margin here, next to verse 5, Revelation chapter 17. Let's finish it up, verse 5. Then the angel who talked with me, probably Jesus, came out and he said to me, well, lift up your eyes now and see. Now, what is this coming forward? Verse 6. So I asked, what is it? And he said, it's a basket. Some of your older old King James says an ephah. Ephah is a dry measure of weight. It was the largest sort of scooper you could have of dry measure, like grains and what have you. It's a basket or an ephah that is coming forward. It's a standard for dry volume measure. It's the largest scoop there is. He also said, this is their resemblance throughout the whole earth. These people who hate God, and God is going to judge, verse 7. And here is a lead disc. A talent is the actual word. And it was a measure, the largest, because when you wanted to measure coins or gold or silver, you had a scale. And then how much gold dust do I have? You had a little clunk on this side. And when they evened out, these were measured. The heaviest clunk you could put on that side of the scale would be a talent. And it was the largest that you could get, 75 pounds. So you have the standard of the ephah, the largest dry grain measure, and the largest talent, weights and measures. This is an idea of commerce. And this is a woman sitting inside the basket. Verse 8, then he said, this is wickedness. And he thrust her down into the basket and put that lid covering over the top. So he clunked that talent, 75 pounds, so that she can't get out. What's going on here? Now, women metaphorically, they basically are standing for beauty, enamoring, even seduction. Jezebel was a woman, and in 1 Kings 21, she seduced Ahab into stealing Naboth's vineyard, and that was awful and terrible. And of course, that was a model of the devil seducing lustful men and why they attack Israel. And in the Great Tribulation, is Israel going to be attacked? Absolutely. The battle of Ezekiel 38 and 39. What's the motivation? Money. Matthew 13, there was a woman who was standing for false religion. She was a woman who hid leaven inside three measures of meal. And that was Jesus telling the parable about the church. The kingdom of heaven is like. And we've studied it before, but it basically is, in the church, there will be seduction of false doctrine and doctrines of demons. Jesus said it shouldn't surprise you. And if you're ever watching a video or somebody, and in this Laodicean church age that we talked about on Sunday, it should not surprise us that potentially, even on Judgment Day, there will be people who led huge churches who will hear from Jesus, "Depart from me, I never knew you." One of the largest churches in the whatever, please understand, the number of humans going to a church is not the indication if the church is a godly one. What is? We saw that on Sunday. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16. God's word is profitable for teaching and correction and reproof, that the man or woman of God may be fully and complete in God's service. And then we saw in 2 Timothy chapter 4, Timothy, preach the what? Word. Preach a book? Preach a movie that came up to illustrate some point? No. Preach the word. And how did Paul do it? The whole counsel, we would say, verse by verse, chapter by chapter, book by book. The Laodicean church age in which we live is going to be replete with anti-Christs. If you weren't here on Sunday, get that video, check it out. And so here we have it displayed for us right here by Zechariah. It's a woman in a basket. Hold your finger here and let's actually check that out. Let's go to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17. Remember, the book of Revelation assumes that we have a working knowledge of our Old Testament. And when you get and when we get to Revelation chapter 17, now we're going to know. All of you Zechariah veterans, are you in Revelation chapter 17? Look at verse 1. Then one of the seven, oh, by the way, what has happened in chapter 16? That's the last and final judgment, so it's all done. Now the camera swings, and this is what we see. Chapter 17, Revelation, verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked to me, saying, come, and I will show you the judgment of a great harlot who sits on many waters. Who is the harlot? Right here, right, Zechariah 5, verse 5. Zechariah 5, verse 5. What's the sitting on many waters about? In verse 15 of this chapter, it says that those many waters are many nations. So what we're going to see here is a woman who was a harlot. And harlotry always is a model of false religion, a love that is not yours. So this great harlot, and we know about her from Zechariah 5, she sits on many nations, verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. So the kings and the people are all, yep, this is the one you want to worship. And the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. She is a false religion. That's who this harlot is. Verse 3. So he carried me in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw that a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. The beast is the Antichrist. The Antichrist is carrying her. Here's what's happening. The rapture takes the true church away from the earth. Who takes over after that? What about those churches that don't need a new pastor because you go to that church after the rapture and the dude is still in the pulpit? He's not saved. What is going to happen is this. The Antichrist is going to help build a one world religion. This will be ecumenicalism at its height. No more of those crazy fundamental Christians over there at Harvest Family Fellowship who keep cramping our style. This is going to be an amalgamation of Islam, Christianity in flying air quotes, Hinduism. All of the religions of the world are going to come together. They're going to lay down their whatever differences, and it's going to be kumbaya. And who is going to be the facilitator of this one world religion? None other than the Antichrist himself. Now, there will be some people after the rapture who are still on planet Earth. They went, oops. Pastor Steve used to tell us about that, or my friend used to tell us about that. Whether it's aliens saying, no, we took all those millions of people that disappeared, we don't know. But remember, God allows a strong delusion. So whatever excuse is given for why those millions of people disappeared, all the video evidence, all the Ring door cameras, they're going to see the UPS guy who was a Christian about ready to ring the doorbell, and all of a sudden, whoop, he just, all of his empty clothes slump to the porch. There are going to be dramatic details and video. But people can get saved after the rapture. But when they do, they gravitate back to the Bible. And what do you think the ecumenical juggernaut thinks about those fundamentalists? They kill them wholesale. It's pretty crazy. Anyway, the woman sits on the scarlet beast. And where does she come from? I'll show you in a minute. She came from Babylon. I'll show you that in just a second. So I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. This is the one world false religion, often modeled by a harlot. And she's on the beast. The Antichrist gave her that position. And it was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and seven horns. That is the Antichrist. Now the woman, verse 4, was arrayed in purple and scarlet. So this is almost royalty. Certainly a tremendous wealth. And adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup. What's in it? Full of the abominations and filthiness of her fornications. Can religion be a money-making machine? Absolutely it can. And some of the richest adornments are in places that Jesus is not. So she has a cup of filthiness. She is full of sexual sin. She is full of covetousness. She is full of murder, of tribulation saints. Verse 5. And on her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. Write in your margin, Zechariah 5, verses 5 through 11. She's the mother of all harlots, plural, and the abominations of all the earth. Verse 6, and I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the who? Saints. People do get saved in the great tribulation, but they pay for it with their heads being lopped off. There's other places that we'll find those specific details. But this one world religion is grinding up true believers. The blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs for Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. That's not like, wow. That's like, oh, it's awful. Interest of time, skip to verse 15. And then he, this angel taking John around heaven, actually, pardon me, not heaven, he has been whisked ahead to the end of the great tribulation. So he said to me, the waters which you saw that the woman or the harlot sits are all the peoples, multitudes, and nations and tongue. Now watch what happens, verse 16. And the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, and make her desolate, naked, and eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. What is that? The rapture takes the true Christians out. Some people will go, uh-oh, I missed it. I better get on the train, and they're going to get saved. But most of the world is going to be caught up in the grandest, most spectacular ecumenical movement of all time. All the religions of the world are going to come together in fabulous facilities, I believe, paid for by the Antichrist himself. He wants the whole world to just kumbaya, let's all get together. But at the midpoint of the Great Tribulation, the Antichrist changes his tune. He becomes indwelt by Lucifer himself. And now this human indwelt by Lucifer says, there is one religion, all right, but it's not that one. The one religion is now me. And he kills and destroys anyone who does not worship him. He turns on the woman and utterly and completely destroys her. Now, the last part of the Great Tribulation is everyone worships me. So does that clear up who the harlot is? Back to the book of Zechariah. Some more details to this harlot. It's going to be pretty spectacular. let's read verse 6 again. What is it? He said, it's a basket. He also said, this is their resemblance throughout the world, and I'm going to put this lead disc right on top of it. And this is a woman sitting inside the basket. Verse 8. And then he said, it's wickedness. It's going to find all idolatry is wickedness. The idea that this is a woman is a notion of seductress and beautiful. And if you don't watch your biblical P's and Q's, you would be sort of seduced to want to connect with her. Don't do it. This harlot is wickedness, and there's been many idolatrous religions. The biggest and the biggest whopper of them all will be after the rapture takes the real Christians out. He thrust her down into a basket, put the covering on the top. Verse 9, and then I raised my eyes and I looked, and here come two more women. These are not angels. Again, why a woman? It's an idea of beauty. It's an idea of, yoo-hoo, come here. These are not angels. These are two seductresses coming with the wind in their wings. So some people say, well, they got wings, so they must be angels, right? Watch. For they had wings like the wings of a stork. Know your Bible, and the Bible will explain itself. Right in your margin here, Leviticus 11, verse 19. Storks are not clean. They are not kosher. These are two women with wings like what? Stork. These are bad girls. Don't go with them. They had wings like a stork. Leviticus 11, verse 19, unclean. This is a notion of evil seduction is coming. And they lifted up the basket between earth and heaven. Literally, we have an air lift going on. Verse 10, so I said to the angel who talked with me, well, where are they carrying the basket? Watch this, verse 11. And he said to me, to build a house for it, the basket really for her, in the land of Shinar. Highlight that or circle that. That is Babylon. You can write Micah 5, verse 6, a.k.a. the land of Nimrod. What did Nimrod found? The city of Babylon. Where is she going? She's going to land one day and live fully there, literally, in the city of Babylon. Bible has rightly been described as the tale of two cities. Which city is God's city? Easy, over 800 times, Jerusalem. Is there a devil city, an anti-city? Yes. Take three guesses who it is. Babylon. And when it is ready, sometime soon, my opinion, during the Great Tribulation and just before. And when it is ready, Babylon the city, the basket will be set there on its what? Base, foundation. We're done here. Oh, actually, you can write next to verse 11, Genesis 10, 1 through 11. Are you sure about that Shinar business, Steve? We're done in Zechariah. Join me in the book of Genesis. Let's check it out. Just to be sure, remember, the Bible is always its own best explainer. Let's go to Genesis 10. The flood of Noah is chapters 6 and following. Now the ark has come to rest. In chapter 10, we're going to get the skippy on who's going where. So the ark is done, and Shem, Ham, and Japheth are now going to build their families. Let's pick up the story. Genesis 10, look at verse 1. Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The sons were born to them after the flood. And so look down there to verse number 8. Verse number 8. Now Cush begot Nimrod. And then write Zechariah 5, verses 5 through 11. Well, what did Nimrod do? He began to be a mighty one on the earth. And that sounds kind of like a glowing, oh, so he was a real cool guy. Mighty in the sense of not good. He was awful. Verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Again, a little misleading. If we read Hebrew, you would see this word in the face of God. He was a mighty hunter and effectively said to God, forget you, I'm awesome. That's who Nimrod is, in the face of God. That's why the transliterations say before God, literally in front of, but to give it a little more cultural understanding, in the face, in God's face. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter in the face of God. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Circle that. He founded the city of Babel. What did they build there at Babel? Do you remember what it was? A little what? Tower. Now the tower, it says, so they could touch the sky. And we're like, oh, those quaint people, they thought that they could get up and touch the blue bowl of the sky. No, no. They knew that the sky, the real sky, was where the stars are. They wanted to build an astrological lookout because they took the 12 constellations on the ecliptic or the approximate pathway of the sun across the sky, and God called it his Maseroth. Psalm 19 says all of those constellations tell a story, and they do. And so the devil says, well, we can't have the gospel going across the sky. I know what I'll do. I'll take those 12 constellations and I will pervert them, and they will become the signs of the zodiac. God's Maseroth. Where does it start? Virgo. What's another way of saying Virgo? Virgin. And then you follow them on across, because each month, the sun, if you go out at the same time, a day or night or twilight, the sun or the moon, you go out each month, every month, it's in a new constellation. And if you know the names of those stars, they tell a gospel story. A virgin. Next one. Yeah, we got a problem. We got a price deficient, but it's offset by a price paid. Keep cruising. You get all the way around, you find out that there is a serpent fleeing. You find out that there's a crux or a cross. And you go all the way around, you get to Cancer, not Cancer, Cancer. And you look up its name and the stars there are, from brightest to least. And you find out that that tells a story that there is an enemy of God holding in his clutches God's people or the sheepfold. And he's eyeing the virgin. I'm going to get you. But there's something standing in the way, the last constellation. What is standing in the way of an enemy trying to attack the virgin and stop the Christ child from being born? It's Leo, the lion of the tribe of Leo. It's fascinating. Well, the devil's all, we can't have that. So he perverts it all and it becomes the zodiac, which is very, very different. God says, stay away from that. And that's why we have here that he built this tower to view the astrological signs more clearly. He was all about the occult. He built Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and in the land of, circle that, what is it? Shinar, Zechariah chapter 5. Can we clear up the mystery? Where will the greatest harlot or false religion eventually have its centroid of power? Are we pretty clear where that's going to be? In the plains of Shinar, Babylon. Well, I think you guys need some slides. I think you really do. Are you ready, Chris? Let's go to our slides. I love slides. I love them. I love them. And then make your way to the book of Revelation chapter 2 as you're making your way over. We're going to show you some slides. Revelation chapter 2, we'll come back to this in just a second. This is all going to tie together. All right, here is the land that that Babylon is about. You heard of these are the plains of Shinar. See where Babylon is there? Can you see where you have the Mediterranean to the left and you have the Arabian Peninsula, Arabian Sea, and then there's kind of acclimating. Those two main rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, are largely understood by anthropologists to be the cradle of humans. Some of the oldest humans found are in this. And then you'll see that those two rivers, they gather much of their salts and sediments and nutrients from the mountains of Asia Minor. And by the time they flow down to the Arabian Sea, that's why that's such a fertile, fertile valley. Now, with your eyes, see the name Syria, and then all the way down, and you're going to see there is Egypt, and you'll see Memphis, and you'll see the Nile River. The Nile River also has some of the oldest human artifacts on the planet. So from the Nile River, especially the Delta, all the way up across the top and down the Tigris-Euphrates, that sea is called the Fertile Crescent. And that's where the oldest humans have been found. You go to an Islamic sort of a place of worship and you'll notice it has a crescent moon. And that crescent moon stands for the Fertile Crescent. So there is Babylon by the red dot. Can you see it? Hit the down arrow, Chris. There is where Baghdad is today. Of course, that's modern day Iraq. Very likely somewhere in this region was where the Garden of Eden probably was. But there's Baghdad today, which is the capital of Iraq. Hit the up arrow, Chris. there is Babylon. You can see they're not far apart, roughly about 70 miles. Down arrow again, there's Baghdad. So you got a basic idea of what we're looking at. Hit the go button. Well, let's go back to Babylon. And in the 1850s, Sir Robert Caldoway dug around and found the edge of this amazing city, 11 miles round. Who conquered Babylon? Answer, nobody did. It basically fell into disrepair. But at its zenith, this is the Euphrates River, and this is the plains of Shinar. This is the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar. It's called the Neo or Newer Babylon. But at its zenith, this was the mighty Babylon. And this artist's depiction is based on archaeological finds. Hit the go button. Up to the top there, that's the big pyramid of Marduk. That was their big god and honcho. And Nebuchadnezzar thought Marduk was all that in a bag of chips. And you're going to find out, as you'll see here in a minute, I'm going to show you that actually everything Marduk is about came from the plains of Shinar. There's Marduk. Hit the go button. It was amazing. It was huge. It was a tower of staggering proportions. And that was a masonry building, so you know how well it had to be engineered. Look at that steep staircase toward the top. Hey, doesn't that sort of ring a bell about some of the Mayan civilizations of Central America? And that's by purpose, because the same devil is kind of behind them both. Yes, at one time, severed heads tumbled down those big, long staircases. But you'll see the city was amazing. The outer walls, you see where the birds or the pigeons are flying off there, those were on average 200 feet high. Hit the go button. We'll go back to the city at large. There's the Euphrates to the right side of the slide. Hit the go button. Here was the mighty palace, of the mighty Nebuchadnezzar. Hit the go button. Here's what it looked like. It was amazing. Those blue tiles are accurate. They were glazed to a beautiful sheen and shine. And there again was the mighty Euphrates River. And you'll see that there are waterfalls cascading off. That is not an artist's indulgence. That's from actual eyewitness accounts. They had water wheels and works and stuff that would take water up to these heights, and then they would cascade them down. The Hanging Gardens of Hammurabi, which predates Mr. Nebuchadnezzar, was a menagerie of animals from all over the world. And they were, you'll notice, palm trees and date trees on all levels. It was staggering, the wealth of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. Go. I hit the go button again. This is the gate of Ishtar, and it was staggering as well. And if you were going to have a big old parade, go, you would then come down this promenade. Can you see that this artist was capturing the brilliant blue stone? Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, Belshazzar, he's having a big old party because Cyrus the Great is rumored to be amassing troops upriver. And Belshazzar says, no worries, they're not going to starve us out, because we have reserves for our entire city for years. Let them knock themselves out. Instead of preparing for battle, he throws a big party. And that's when a hand shows up and writing starts happening on the wall. Mene tekel upharsin, you've been found wanting, and you're going to die tonight. What happens is, I'll show you in just a minute, Cyrus upriver diverts the Euphrates into the irrigation systems, and at the wall, the river drops in elevation, and his commandos go under the wall, and they come through the city, and they open up those gates, the Ishtar gates. A few weeks later comes the mighty Cyrus. The Persian king goes right down that promenade right there and goes through those gates, the Ishtar gates. That's where he is met by Daniel, who shows him his name in the Bible. What about those gates? Man, too bad we couldn't really see them. Hit the go button, Chris. Yes, you can, because there they are. That's amazing. Caldoway and subsequent archaeologists, Caldoway was German, and so he found most of those stones. That is not spiffed up for the tourists. That's basically washed off and stacked and those are the actual Ishtar gates that he found. He took them brick by brick back to Berlin, and that's where this is on display. And as you might imagine, the Iraqis are kind of sore about that. They want their Ishtar gates back. So there's some legal battles going. But there is the actual Ishtar gates, and you can go to the Pergamum Museum in Berlin and look at them. Go. They're staggering. Those are them, you guys. King Cyrus walked under those gates. Fascinating. Go. Looking up a little closer, their big mascot was a lion. And in other locations, you'll see lions with wings. And that's important in our Bible study in the book of Daniel, when the creature that he sees lying with wings, that's Babylon. Go. Now, I want you to see upriver, hit the go button. Here's a line. His troops, a few of them, came down, floated down that river that had been diverted. It's in October. And at that wall, the water level dropped. That's when the commandos went under the wall and they met some bars there. They sawed through those bars, hit the go button. Then they scurried across town, right to the east gate, Ishtar gates, and they opened the gates to the rest of the army that was on the outside, and in one night, the mighty Babylon fell to the Persians. A stunning victory that is still studied in military academies to this day. Go, hit the go button. Well, the archaeologists, there's another shot of it. Hit the go button again. Some of those are 2,500 years old. Hit the go button. Now, there were other archaeologists that found other things, and an English archaeologist found that rock there in the middle, and that's called the Cyrus Cylinder. Hit the go button. This is in London. And he found one half in one dig, and several years later, he found the other half. And they found it, by the way, in the ruins of the big ziggurat, or that big pyramid, to Marduk. And they put them together, go, and you can zoom in on it, and it tells a story. And in that story, it tells of how King Cyrus won that battle and why we know the specifics of what happened. That's cuneiform, put into a wet clay, and then eventually fired and made hard into the cylinder that laid buried for almost 2,000 years. Go. There's a Cyrus stone. This is fascinating. Before Saddam Hussein, who featured himself and thought of himself as a modern-day Persian king, and he said that he was directly descended from King Cyrus, and he might be. So what he did was, is he built the old Babylon. He started to rebuild new. He would send bricks and masonry and engineering and money and funds 70 miles upstream. And he began, did Saddam Hussein, to rebuild the old Babylon. Go, not just the old Babylon. This is a fascinating picture. Behind there, that's the new walls. In the foreground, that's the old walls. Some of those stones could be upwards of 3,500 years old and date back to Hammurabi. And behind them, the new stones of what Saddam Hussein could build. This is what's really amazing to me. Go. He then looked at and found on his archaeology, that is Nebuchadnezzar's old palace, or I should say, built on the foundations. In the forefront to the bottom, there's your Euphrates River. Saddam Hussein was firmly convinced that he found the actual outline of Nebuchadnezzar's palace, and he rebuilt it. Go. And this is absolutely gives me shivers down my spine. You remember Operation Desert Storm? And so when our Marines got there and we took over, that is a U.S. Marine soldier, and he is walking on the marble of the rebuilt palace of Nebuchadnezzar. What is fascinating to me is that great room supposedly was built right on top of the old great room and potentially was the place where Belshazzar was drinking booze out of relics that his grandfather took from the Jewish temple in Herod's day. that the writing on the wall took place. That is a U.S. serviceman walking potentially within the same confines of Nebuchadnezzar's palace. Does anybody get a little chill bumps when you think about stuff like that? Hit the go button. There was Nimrod in his Tower of Babel. The Bible says very specifically in the book of Zechariah, the greatest harlot, the greatest pseudo-religion, antichrist religion, is going to be moved to what location? The plains of Shinar. Nimrod did it once. The antichrist will do it again. Go. And he is going to build the greatest city that the humans will ever and have ever known. And the Bible says in Revelation 18, the entire world slack-jawed about this amazing Babylon, the anti-city. And in Revelation chapter 18, something happens. And in one hour, that whole city is done. We're going to end with this. Revelation chapter 2. I want to show you something. Look at verse number 12. And to the angel of the city of Pergamos. The word Pergamos means objectionable marriage. And you saw us on Sunday. This is when the state marries the church. And it gets weird from there. To the angel of the church of Pergamos write, these things says he who has a sharp two-edged sword. What's a sharp two-edged sword? It's the Bible. The Bible always cuts the legs out from false religion, the harlot. But notice what's happening here in Pergamos, verse 13. I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. And you hold fast to my name, there are some Christians there, and do not deny my faith even in the days which Antipas and my faithful martyr, we're going to look at all this when we do the book of Revelation, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. There's twice. There's something that you need to know. Pergamum is 48 miles north of Smyrna. Ephesus was the great political center and a financial center. Smyrna was a great commercial center. Pergamos was a religious center. And why was it so religious? Prior to Alexander the Great, it was mostly a castle on a big hill, a strong fortification, well-suited to be a bank. So a lot of money was there. The Greek control was about to wane, so the city fathers saw the changing wind. Romans are coming. So they allied themselves with the upstart Romans. And when the Romans did roll through, they prospered greatly. It was a Roman capital. The region for the next 200 years was Pergamos. Now, according to the Greeks, Zeus was born in Pergamum. There was a great altar and a statue 150 feet tall. Maybe that's the seat of Satan. No. When Cyrus the Great conquers Babylon, he found in Babylon and was so enamored by the mystical arts from the plains of Shinar. You need to know something, that every astrology, occultism, weird, spiritual, whatever, all came and started where? Babylon. That's where Nimrod got started. And so the College of Occultism was there. When Cyrus the Great rolls through, he runs into that College of Weirdness and Occultism. And by the way, it was really something. Astral projection, levitation, demonic goings-ons, and he was very impressed by it. So King Cyrus moves the university of the priesthood to Pergamum. 63 BC, the Roman general Pompey conquers Pontus in Asia Minor. He runs into Pergamum. He also runs into the College of the Wacky and the Wild. And he came under the same spell because they were doing bona fide, supernatural stuff. He moves the university and the priesthood from Pergamum to Rome. And now the centroid of idolatry and occultism, magical arts and magistrates from Babylon are now in Rome. No, that didn't happen. Yes, it did. Go. If you're interested in this, you might read this guy. His name is Alexander Hislop. He was 1807 to 1865. He was a Scottish theologian. He wrote The Tale of Two Babylons in 1853. He documents the mother of God fetish of Semiramis and Tammuz from Babylon. Okay, Steve, take a breath. Let's all stand. We're done.